The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and we have a terrific show planned for you today on a very historic July 20th day. And just as President Kennedy said, why we go to the moon, perhaps we will be able to soon create a space commodities future trading exchange for the space industry, and that's what we're going to be talking about today in a few minutes. And as I said, a great historical day to be having this conversation on the Space Show program. You can give us a call at 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient, let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And I do answer the phone during the break, so don't let the break stop you from using the phone, which, by the way, is our preferred way of communicating with our listeners. Email, of course, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments on the blog, and I will get those as soon as you hit the send button. To do that, go to our website, thespaceshow.com, and all the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu, and open the first page. That is for today's program. It is also the blog and archive page, so comments are down at the bottom. And as I said, as soon as you post your comment, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on the show. While you're at the website, do visit our website newsletter, center right on our homepage. It is uploaded fresh every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program ends. And not only does it show the newsletter activities for the coming week, it shows you all the programs we have planned for the future, and we're just about through with August and coming into the final part of third quarter 2018. And everything we do is archived, so you can very quickly download a program, as the files are not all that big, and you can also listen right off of our website. Upper left has a menu. You'll see it, and under support there is a store in case you're interested in Space Show logo wear. There's also another button upper left called Listen Live. Please share this information with people. And it tells you how to listen to live programs, compressed MP3 archives on our website, and also podcasting programs, including those of you using Alexa, as the tune-in player is embedded on our website. To me, the most important information is supporting the Space Show. So do remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and your support is needed. This is a listener-supported program. So remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift to the Space Show, and the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. In California, we're a public benefit corporation. Visit our parent nonprofit, 1-O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, or email me for more information, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We thank you for your support, and again, without your support, there simply would not be a Space Show program. And there is also sponsors for the Space Show. So sponsors do get a banner ad that goes across our website. They can change it as frequently as possible. And on a full-length program, as is today's program, they get a short message that we read on the first segment and the second segment. So for the first segment sponsors today, we have Northrop Grumman, the leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions for government as well as commercial customers. And they cover a wide range of portfolio and capability technologies from undersea to outer space, including cyberspace. The Space Foundation is also a sponsor, spacefoundation.org. And right now they have their annual space report on the industry and, in fact, a comprehensive look at the space industry. And you can see that on their homepage, again, spacefoundation.org. The Space Development Network is also a sponsor, and they invite others to join with them to advance the plan for space development and settlement. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join. So do check it out, and their website is spacedevelopment.org. And then the National Space Society is a sponsor, and they're NSS.org. They support many different fields in the space movement and subjects and groups that we support, like space settlement. So, again, do visit their website, attend ISDC, which every year is around Memorial Day, and their website, NSS.org. And so we have two guests with us today. A couple of weeks ago, actually about a month ago, because the paper was published online May 11th, I read a paper titled Space Commodities Future Trading Exchange, Adapting Terrestrial Market Mechanisms to Grow a Sustainable Space Economy. And I will put a link up in the archives to this particular paper online. And two of its co-authors are with us. Bruce Cahan is with us, and so is Bruce Pittman, a returning Space Show guest. So those of you who listen to a lot of shows are very familiar with Bruce Pittman. He is at NASA Ames Research Center. He works as a contractor. He's a chief engineer, systems engineer in the NASA Space Portal office. He's involved in many commercial space projects. He also is involved in National Space Society and other organizations. I suggest you read his full bio rather than my reading about him, because we certainly want to start talking to him as well as Bruce Cahan. And Bruce Cahan is a consulting professor at Stanford in the School of Engineering. He is co-founder of Stanford Sustainable Banking Initiative, a former CodeX fellow at Stanford Center for Legal Informatics, and an Ashoka fellow. In Silicon Valley, he is creating Good Bank TM as a teaching hospital bank for high transparency, impacts-aware financial services to shift the culture of banks and bankers. And those of you who have attended some select space conferences, especially those focusing on new space and commercial space in recent years, have heard Bruce Cahan talk about the commodities future trading idea. I certainly heard him talk about this a couple of years ago at a new space conference. Because they're both Bruce, I'm going to refer to Bruce Pittman as Pittman and Bruce Cahan as Cahan. And I suggest you read their bios. Their full bios are up on the website. Most impressive for both of them. And we're going to start out with Bruce Cahan. And Cahan, can you introduce us to what you're talking about vis-a-vis a space commodities future trading exchange? Is this on the order of what we're familiar with Chicago, for example?
Yeah, thank you for having us. And I'm sorry for the confusion about the Bruce and Bruce. We don't get confused. Maybe others do. But it's been a delight to collaborate with Bruce Pittman and his insights, which I'm looking forward to having him share. The notion of a space commodities exchange actually as a result of a conflict and at what kind of recommendations should be made to facilitate the growth of commercial space. And not knowing any better, I've blurted out, you all must have a space commodities exchange. And the looks in the room were talking about. So very simply, a commodities exchange, which goes back historically to Greek and Roman times, is marketplace for reducing two kinds of risk. One is liquidity risk. Liquidity means the cash flows from the activity. If it were farming, it would be the cash flows between when you plant the seeds and when you harvest and get paid the grain, and the risk of that activity that you're trying to undertake, which, as you and Bruce can tell me much more, is space is a very risky proposition. The technology is risky. Politics is risky. Lots of it is risky. And so marketplaces for commodities tend to normalize and trade in those risks. We have catastrophic disaster risk. We have cyber risk. We have many risks that actually can be made into a form of insurance and traded. In the case of the Space Commodities Exchange, we've identified five buckets of commodities. So first bucket might be raw materials that you could obtain from the moon or other bodies, such as rock with ice in it that could be purified into water and into energy. The purified version of that would be the second bucket, processed goods, such as orange juice from oranges. And there you have very different grades of that processed good. If you actually go to the USDA, the Department of Agriculture website, they'll give you all different versions of oranges and orange juice. The third bucket are services. So raw materials, processed goods, and now services. Services we have a lot of already in LEO and low Earth orbit, whether it's bandwidth or imagery or hopefully debris removal. Fourth bucket are financial derivatives of the first three. So those risk transfer items plus the futures of those. And the fifth bucket are indexes, commodity indexes of the first four. So I wanted a bucket of, as an investor, of LEO commodities. I would perhaps invest in a commodity index for LEO.
You're cutting out a little bit, Cahan. I don't know if you switched to some kind of speakerphone or something, but there is some cutting out due. I don't know if you can make any adjustments at your end or not.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Let me know. It's better.
For either one of you who might be able to respond to this, are we ready for the commodities space futures exchange today, or are we simply moving toward it, and what would it take to actually be ready to have such an exchange? Whoever wants to answer that.
Well, let me take, this is Pittman. Let me take a crack at that. One of the things that, you know, until I started working with Cahan, I had no idea. I mean, I kind of vaguely knew about futures exchanges and all that, but didn't really know what the purpose was for them and all that. It just seemed to me to be this kind of abstract thing that was probably useful, but that I didn't understand. But the one thing that Cahan made clear to me is one of the things that the purpose of this is to align buyers and sellers. So if you're a producer, you want to make sure that there's a customer for your product. And if you're somebody that's going to depend on somebody providing a product at a certain time frame in a certain place, you want to make sure that there's actually somebody out there who's willing to sign up for that. And it literally is the original origin of the chicken and the egg thing. You know, if you build it, will they come? If you want it, you know, will somebody provide it to you? And so this is a way of aligning those markets. And from that sense, I think we are at that point right now, because we're getting to the point where people are actually looking at going and mining resources out in space. You know, there's a number of companies that have stated their intention to go do this over the next decade. And there's certain people, you know, notably ULA has made it clear that they are willing to buy water and hydrogen and oxygen in space at a price. So we are now, I think, at that point in time where a conversation like this about an exchange that could help formalize this and help facilitate this process is very timely.
Let me just
okay.
support that. I mean, yeah, as Bruce says, without this type of contract mechanism to visualize who wants to buy what, where, in what orbit, in what quantity, of what quality, and what interoperable standard of it, you as an investor and as a entrepreneur might not have the certainty of where supply and demand meet for the space economy in that realm. And so this objectifies and quantifies how much of whatever you're trying to build an asset to obtain or to provide is actually needed, so you don't get an oversupply of imagery or an undersupply of water or whatever, given all the risks involved in creating those commodities. It also makes it much easier for those who are the genius engineers and scientists who can have many different technologies to provide the commodity to focus on what they're really good at, which is those technologies, as opposed to who's my customer, as Bruce says, and not knowing how much of what you want to build they want to buy at what pace. The other thing it does is to let missions be manifested where the redundancy of what you would need could, over time, be provided by other actors. And that's an assurance of safety as well as cost that this could provide.
So I already have an email question for either one of you or both of you from Josh, who is in Phoenix, Arizona. And Josh says, when I think of commodities trading, I think of things like coffee or some other kind of things, potatoes, gasoline futures, things of that. Normally, these markets are much riskier than even the regular stock market, and sometimes the qualifications to participate in a commodities transaction are stricter and higher than just buying regular stocks. Do you see this type of commodities market in the same light, in that it would be extremely risky for investors, or is somehow the space commodities market a little tamer than what many of us think commodities future trading is in the United States? And also, based on what you just said, Kahan, is it mission by mission, or is it in general for a commodities future trading exchange?
So the answer is that these markets would be public markets. As the paper describes, we would imagine this to be a DCM, a designated contracts market, and the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, has jurisdiction in the U.S. over such market licensing and regulation. So that would be open as a public market. Is it for sophisticated investors or accredited investors? Probably. That's the right answer, because most of it is functional to the mission requirements in the public and private sectors. But I think it's a good question. How could a mutual fund, for instance, invest in the types of financial futures that we're talking about? In terms of mission focus, no, it's not just mission by mission. These commodities are planned and are provided by commercial space on an ongoing basis. And whether it's launch services, CubeSats, or larger objects, these are going to be, in a vibrant space economy, and I'll defer to Bruce, needed to be assured, just like you would expect FedEx cargo to be able to take a box from California to New York. Not because Bruce or I want to ship something one day, but because that's part of the economic vitality of transportation for us.
I have a question. Since most of the new space companies are privately held and are not traded on any exchange as of this time, does that make a difference in commodities trading? I'm not a commodities trader, so I don't know. So do you need public companies to be able to do this, or can private companies be involved as well? Either.
It actually creates more openness to the investment opportunities for the space economy to invest not only in a company that happens to be focused on a particular commodity, and we can think about, you know, the usual large private companies who are doing what they're doing. You may not want, as an investor, to invest just in that company. You may want to invest in the commodity and the portfolio of commodities for launch, imagery, bandwidth, data processing in orbit that would represent for you a slice of the larger portfolio you're assembling terrestrially as well as up in space. So the answer is that the market would be an open market and everybody could play as far as, you know, but for the accredited investor question, which is a good question.
So David, this is Titman. Let me kind of bring the space perspective. I think one of the challenges that we're talking about here is again, this is a nascent, emerging market. So I would say anytime you're in that thing, you're basically betting for or against the emergence of this market. So I think that in itself brings some inherent risk to it, because there is not a thriving market out there for, you know, lunar or asteroid water or the other kind of things that we're talking about, other than communications and things like that, and maybe now Earth observation. There is no real well-established or very few well-established markets out there. So I think that is. And you know, I would say anybody that's thinking of investing and doing anything in space, it's one, not for the faint of heart, and two, there's a pretty steep learning curve. It is an esoteric area. There's a lot of nuances to this. As everybody's been saying over the years, it has been reinforced many times, space is hard. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. Some of them are very non-intuitive, non-obvious kinds of things. So you need to make sure that you really understand the risks of what you're getting yourself into, and of the potential suppliers, their sophistication and track record in being able to address things like that. That being said, I think that these commodities futures markets for space could be a mechanism to, as Kahan said, to give you the visibility into this and to provide some transparency to this. So it's not like I can go to this guy because, you know, I met him at a cocktail party last week and he seems like a good guy, but you can get more information about the track records. And, you know, like one of the things that I like a lot is, when you go to Amazon and you're looking at one of their other providers, they'll give you an evaluation of how many of what percentage of successful transactions did they do. So if you're dealing with somebody that has a very low approval rating in the responses, then you may not want to do business with those, and you may want to pay a little bit more, but go with somebody who's got a better track record. So I think those are some of the things that I'm hoping come out of this this kind of setting up of this kind of an exchange, is it would give you this transparency and allow more people, maybe with less sophistication, to be able to enter into this while still achieving a reasonable risk profile.
And David, let me add to what Bruce said, because it's really key. When you look at how the Intercontinental Commodities Exchange, known as ICE, I-C-E, not to be confused with a different ICE, when you look at where they get their revenue, it breaks down that 54% of their revenue, or about $620 million a year, comes from the data and the listings that they do, not from the transactions and the fees for the transactions, but actually from selling the data about what the transactions are to to whom they're important, when they occur, and how they align. So I find that fascinating. It's a really buttresses Bruce's point that what this is transparency into how the space economy is developing as much as the ability to invest in that economy as it grows.
So I have another email question for you from Helen, who is in Seattle, who's been emailing us a lot lately and seems to be very well-versed in space. She says many of the functions for the commodities exchange you referenced earlier, like deep space mining, for example, have a regulatory connotation to them, yet there are controversies because of the Outer Space Treaty. Is the Commodities Futures Trading Exchange at all affected or limited or somehow restricted or made more risky because of the various UN treaties, especially the Outer Space Treaty, but maybe even the Moon Treaty, though the United States and the USSR never signed the Moon Treaty?
So I'm a lawyer in three states, California, Pennsylvania, and New York, so I have to make that disclaimer to everybody in listening land. And Helen, I appreciate your comments and your question from that point of view. Yeah, there's an aspect of this that the space treaties have left a void for commercial space and have not made it very clear how the rights to specific assets on a body in space could be resold or could even be claimed. That being said, there seems to be assurance that once you put a space object or you put it, it ought to be left untouched and unmolested, and that the national registrant of that body should be using its internal laws to govern that body. In a prior paper on space banking, how to bank in space, we reviewed space treaties applicable to this type of activity. I'll say two things. First, a space commodities exchange would provide some additional self-governance and self-regulation amongst the members of the exchange to frankly respect each other's rights, such as they may be, to the commodities that are being traded under the standardized contracts. And that self-restraint and mutual respect and would go a long way in a practical sense to saying who can trade what, and if somebody is a bad actor, you want to deal with them. Probably not. Second, by specifying in the terms of the contract how you would deal with the vagaries of the space treaties might accelerate the number of transactions that can occur given the vagaries of those. My next step with forming the exchange is to create a board of trade, BOT, which is how the Chicago Exchange and other exchanges first started, and to do that, frankly, in a nonprofit mode for a while, to be able to do two things. First, to define what is a space commodity in the five buckets that I've shared. And then what are the contract terms under which those commodities as defined should be traded for the purpose of the buyer and seller contract, and in that contract to get into the gaps in the space treaties as well as some other commercial principles for honoring the contract.
So let me weigh in here for a second, because
okay.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and let me make my caveat as well that although I'm a contractor at NASA Ames, these comments are solely mine and not NASA. But this is, you know, in my role at, with the National Space Society, this is something that we have looked at a lot and have explored a lot over the years, because this is something that's very important to our vision for the future, is having access to these resources. And this is one of those areas where I think the situation has improved remarkably in the last few years. If you go back to 2015, the Space Resources Exploration and Utilization Act was passed and signed into law at the end of that year. And one of the things it says is in Article 3, it says, promote the right of United States commercial entities to explore outer space and utilize space resources in accordance with the existing international obligations of the United States, free from human interference, and to transfer or sell such resources. So what the Congress is basically saying is, although you can't own the moon, you can't own it, I guess the best analogy that I've heard, David, is the one about, like, fishing in international waters. If you are fishing in international waters, you don't own the ocean, you don't own the fish in it, but once you catch the fish, it's yours. And so that you know, that gives you some kind of intellectual framework. And then the other thing that's, I think, important in the way that terrestrial law works is, when you're operating at sea in international waters, you have the right to non-interference. So there, and this is stated in the treaties as well, if you're doing something in space, that other people are not supposed to interfere with you. That's part of the Outer Space Treaty. Now, what exactly that means, what kind of exclusionary zone is reasonable to do, some of these things need to be worked out. But I would have to say that I'm encouraged that the United States did this in 2015. Luxembourg has followed, and with something even more expansive than what the United States did. I think I think the UAE is considering something similar as well. So I think that there's a trend in this direction. Obviously, there's a lot of details to be worked out. And with all due respect to my co-author, interesting things can happen when you get the lawyers involved. But I'm hopeful.
God bless the lawyers. Space too.
Or you could say the 180 degrees opposite of God bless lawyers too. Both would,
yeah, I know Shakespeare.
both would be correct. So clearly, the emerging commercial space and the new space and even the traditional aerospace commercial economy for space is growing. I mean, if one follows the very many economic reports on space, there are a lot of them, plus the one I mentioned from my sponsor, the Space Foundation, you can see growth year by year by year. And there hasn't been a commodities futures trading exchange for space. So my question is, what happens to this growth if this kind of orderly and transparent process is not made available in the near to intermediate term? Can space continue to grow, and can it continue to prosper, or is it going to run into problems? And then the other part of the question is, does the commodities future trading exchange significantly facilitate and stabilize space economic growth, or does it just do it a tiny bit, like on the margins, or is it a game changer?
Well, I know Bruce has an opinion on the former, what happens if we don't have an exchange. But I'll weigh in really quickly. If we don't have an exchange, for space commodities, then we continue in the bespoke, custom-tailored nature of some of the important commodities, such as launch, such as mission definitions. And there will always be a reason for bespoke, whether it's the military or corporate needs, such as for banks or whatever it may be. But when I analogize it to, and I have some history with the geospatial industry, early on in the pre-90s era, there were a few large vendors of geospatial software with proprietary formats that could not easily align to show me a complete What we would look at is Google Earth view of California. So you had to buy licenses with each of the vendors and then buy the data sets that were built into those licenses. That didn't get you Google Maps or Apple Maps, and didn't get you location-based services. What got you those things were the interoperability of open geospatial standards, and then people producing data and other services with those and for those standards. So the explosion of the pie of geospatial happened as a result of some of those standards, many of which were motivated by the federal government and the national, as the National Spatial Data Infrastructure. So with that kind of history, and we've seen that in other interoperability standards develop, the underpinning for the reasons that that economies grew. One of our examples in the paper is that we needed a transcontinental railroad, according to President Lincoln, to get the troops from the East Coast to California to protect us from the Russian invasion feared then. Sometimes life repeats. And in order to have a consistent rail quality of steel, it was determined that you needed a commodities exchange to specify how that steel would be graded so that the locomotives wouldn't sag on the rail on the way out to California. And there tends to be a reason for these commodities markets to grow, both from an economic as well as from a national security point of view. And so if we don't have the regularization, the commodification of things you're going to just need to be generically available in space, the cost of missions are going to grow to have it all, you know, many redundantly available. And the different versions of what you need may not show up in the form you need it. Imagine you had a 220 plug and a 120 plug for energy in space, and you're outside the lunar or the ISS replacement, and you can't get refueled. That won't work well. So we do need some commodification just to make space accessible at a reasonable price.
Well, David, I think there's another aspect of that. I could just chime in on that. I think one of the things, you know, you said, what happens if we don't have this? And the vision that comes to my mind is, you know, you're back to the Wild West where there's really no rules and, you know, it's just kind of somewhat chaotic. There's still interesting things happening, but there's a lot of chaos and confusion. And is that claim that I just bought really a claim, or is, you know, am I being scammed here? So I think that's one of the elements in this. And then I think the other part of this is I think that that having this kind of mechanism, this kind of exchange in place, could greatly accelerate the development of this kind of deep space economy that a lot of us are hoping is going to emerge over the coming decades. And it's not like if we didn't have it, is it going to stop it? No, I think it will definitely impede it and slow it down and make it more risky for a wide variety of players for a number of the reasons that Cahan just brought out, that there's a lot of things that can benefits that you can get from this other than just, you know, lining up buyers and sellers. And I think this whole idea of standards and standard mechanisms, standard interfaces and those kinds of things would be one of the things here. And clearly there's a role for government in this as well. So it's not just the exchange there, but that helping to coordinate the regulatory environment that would go along with that, I think it would be part of this development process as well.
I think we have time for this question. Paul is in upstate New York, and he says, I would venture that the space community, especially the commercial space community, is totally decentralized, though there are some kinds of organizations like the Commercial Space Federation and possibly some others. So with such a diverse and widespread decentralized industry, where do you start to try to create a space commodities future exchange there? Who votes on it and who has power or authority to vote? I don't understand how you can create something when everything is so decentralized and there are no authority figures or organizations speaking for the industry as a whole. Whoever wants to take that.
I think that's a Cahan question. Okay. So the reason that we're looking at the history by which other commodities exchanges have formed is there's been decentralization and frankly chaos in those markets pre-commodities exchange. And to bring some order into the financialization of of those commodity markets is the work of a board of trade, as I've suggested, where folks who both would be producers of commodities, but also investors and financiers and buyers of those commodities, all of those groups would be represented in a board of trade. And through that mechanism, have the pragmatic knowledge, the knowledge that Bruce Pittman and National Space Society and many others who are active in the industry, they know what the definition of launch for inanimate objects of a certain size might look like. How would you define that commodity? How would you define the energy, kilowatt hours, and joules? And what would you do? I mean, you don't want the lawyers or the bankers on Wall Street making these definitions. You want the industry participants to make these definitions. And there are a number of existing subgroups that have been have the specialization for whether it's bandwidth or whether it's launch, the different commodities. So there are groups with this expert knowledge who, as an additional opportunity, could be contributing into this board of trade to do the two things I described before, the defining of what is the commodity, how can it be standardized, and what are the different grades and measures of that standard commodity, and then what are the contract terms under which it should be traded so that risks can be appropriately allocated between the two sides of the contract. Last time I checked, there's not just one farmer producing the wheat that goes into our cereal. It's a diversity of, sadly, not as many family farms as we used to have, but in the beginning, in the 40s, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange goes back to 1850. So it's a long time of diverse actors needing a centralizing facility, not to tell them how to grow the wheat, but to tell them how they would trade it once it's harvested and goes to market so they can see how much to actually plant. So decentralization is not a reason not to have the commodities exchange. It probably is more of a reason to have it. Plus, what motivated me and I think us in thinking about this is we want there to be more opportunity for new space actors to enter. And if they know that there's a commodity that's been defined and they have a better technology for building it or servicing it, then so be it. They don't have to convince their investors that the commodity is needed because it's already being traded on the exchange. So that should make it easier for them to raise funds.
Who invites who to be on the Board of Trade?
I've been doing an open call to, this is a project that is sponsored at this point by my nonprofit, Urban Logic,
And it's an open call to old and new space, to government, to, financial intermediaries to come forward, and we'll convening of the Board of Trade, hopefully in the fall. But we'll see when the time is ripe to bring people together.
Listeners, we're at our break point, so we're going to pause for a couple of minutes. And we will be back with Bruce and Bruce and more on this topic. If you do want to give us a call, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223 if you have access to the phone. And email is fine, and you can continue using that, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we will be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody, to part two. We're talking about a possible space commodities future trading exchange. And we'll get back to our two guests in just a minute. But first of all, we do have sponsors for the second segment, and one such sponsor is the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race, and you can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. And if you go to their website, which is thespaceplan.com, you can see the interactive version and lots of other activities on their website. And you can also order a full-size copy of the Space Plan. So again, the Space Plan, all one word, .com. AIAA is a sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society, and they have 5 forums per year, or conferences. And their networking is incredible, and they have a vast library of reviewed papers going back many, many, many years on almost any subject you can think of, and that is available. And you should check it out. Their website is AIAA.org, and you should attend their events. And again, great networking. And then Celestis is also a sponsor, and they are still the only proven provider of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. And for a space enthusiast, there can be no more fitting choice for a personal final journey than the Celestis Memorial spaceflight. They do advanced planning and pre-arrangement. They will launch a portion of your cremated remains, or DNA if you don't cremate, into space. You can do Earth orbit, and you can do suborbital, and you can do lunar flights. And at some point, there probably will be a flight to Mars as well. And you can also add your own DNA to the DNA or the ashes of your loved one to join them symbolically, so to speak. So check it out. Make some advanced arrangements. And it's a great way to memorialize and honor the lives of people that are really important, and a great closure as well. And remember, I am their customer. I've done 3 flights with my mom and my 2 dogs. And I cannot speak highly enough of Celestis. So that brings us back to our show today. So remember, if you want to call us, the toll-free number is 866-687-7223. For those of you at work and not with access to calling a talk show while you're at work, email is fine. drspace@thespaceshow.com. I guess I'll start out and ask either one of you or both of you. We hear today for commercial business, public-private partnerships, they seem to be stronger today and more desirable today than even a few years ago. So what is the role of government, and does it come in the form of a public-private partnership for commodities, future exchange, or just in the regulatory role? How is government seen as facilitating the growth of this new industry? Either one of you or both of you.
Yeah, let me take that one. This is another topic there's been a lot of discussion on, and of what is the appropriate role for government in all this. And clearly, as far as some of these standards and regulations go, there's clearly a regulatory role. But I think one of the things, and again, this is my personal opinion, one of the things, if you look back historically, whether it was the Transcontinental Railroad that Kahan brought up earlier, the government underwrote the financing of that with bonds that were eventually paid back by the railroads. But I dare say that it would not have been, put in place without those and the land grant that went along with it, where the United States government basically gave away land equivalent to about something the size of Texas to make sure that the Transcontinental Railroad got built for strategic reasons. So I think that's one of the things. And then acting as an anchor customer, if you go back to the 1925 Kelly Airmail Act, the government put in place an airmail not only to provide a service for the country, but to help support the fledgling airline industry by providing government financing to fly the airmail. And this was really what kept a lot of these airlines that are still with us today, like United, in place until the advent of the DC-3, a decade later, when they could actually make money on just flying passengers. So there was a real key role that the government played there. So could a similar kind of role on Earth? We have the Strategic Petroleum Reserves for helping the United States in emergencies and to help stabilize, prices to a certain extent. So one of the ideas that has been floated in the past that I thought was quite interesting was this idea of having a strategic propellant reserve. So you would have water or hydrogen and oxygen in space that the government could buy for future use that would help bootstrap or jumpstart this space economy if water, either from asteroids or from lunar sources, is one of the markets that you're looking for. Could that be a way to help bootstrap that? And that would help us in the NASA 2017 authorization. There was an interesting thing as far as the long-term goals for NASA, and one of it was to enable a thriving space economy in the 21st century. So could that be part of the mechanism by which the U.S. government would assist in establishing that thriving space economy?
So I think Bruce is spot on in citing these examples, and that terrestrially the government has been a key catalyst for the commercialization of various advances. But I also want to talk about the flip side of that, and that is that while the country was trying to decide on whether to standardize on gold or silver as its official, at the time, fiat currency, people were building railroads to both silver and gold mines. and some of the railroad to the silver mine collapsed, and with it they brought a number of recessions, including a piece of the Great Depression, so that you could have conceivably multiple activities, assuming a demand curve that would not be supported in reality, or that would be artificially buoyant. And so you want to see transparently, well, if we build a certain capacity in space, who's our customer? When are they going to arrive, and how much are they going to need? And then it turned out I had no idea that AIAA would be a sponsor of the show, but I'll be speaking and presenting a version of the space commodities paper that I'm writing now with a colleague from USAF to talk about what is the military implication of having or not having a commodities exchange in space, and how does that serve the needs of our national interests in space, including the regular supply of some very rare commodities and minerals that are needed, such as what you might need to build solar cells. So the normalization of these supply chains for a vibrant space economy is part of what's underneath the space commodity exchange idea. The other thing that's underneath it is perhaps some early revenues in the form of the contracts that could be injected into the space economy before the actual asset, the rocket to make the launch is flying. So that addresses some of the liquidity concerns of a very nascent economy such as the space economy.
I have another question from you, and Larry is in Denver, Colorado, and he said, since you mentioned national needs and possible national security, if all of a sudden we have national security interest in space in the form of commodities, does that make space more likely to be a warfighter's paradise battlefield? Does that suggest that we should go to a separate military space force rather than letting the Air Force handle it as it is today?
That's above my pay grade.
Pittman, do you have any thoughts on that?
I would have the same kind of cop out. I guess what it would say is, you know, clearly space is an important strategic asset right now. If you just look at you know, the satellite constellations that both the civilian, the commercial, and the national security space depend on, both in low Earth orbit, higher orbits, and geostationary orbit. I mean, so we already have a lot of strategic assets in space right now. We're talking about diversifying that and adding to that portfolio. But what's the best mechanism to protect those assets? Again, I think that's beyond the scope of what you can expect from a commodities future exchange, but think it certainly raises some questions about if you're going to have this thriving space economy, then how do you regulate it, and how do you you know, like if you're sending ships, you know, through, I guess it's not what it used to be, but the piracy, you know, off of the east coast of Africa there was kind of phenomenal, you know, so if you have valuable resources that are going back and forth today, you know, could you have space pirates? I remember reading Tom Corbett, you know, Space Cadet, when I was that was the first science fiction book I ever read, was called On the Trail of the Space Pirates. So, you know, how would you, you know, I don't know how likely that is to ever happen, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility. And so how would you do that? So whether you need a space force or a space guard, you know, there's a number of different mechanisms that you could have. Should this be national? Should this be international? It raises a bunch of intriguing questions that, again, I am not qualified to speculate on.
I mean, the one thing that I would add, David, just because I agree with everything Bruce said, is that if commercial parties are acting in space and are doing so under a national flag, then it does become a national concern to protect their activities and to regulate their activities in space, which was the essence of the space treaties, but also part of the essence of the space treaties was that space should be open for exploration by all humankind. And to the extent that the commodities exchange makes it easier for good actors, not just the bad actors, which we don't want to be in space, but good actors to create STEM and other programs for using space for agriculture and insurance and other good reasons, then that's a good thing, and that serves our national interests to that extent. The other thing is the ability of a market to self-police under the appropriate regulatory regime, such as the Commodity Futures Trading Commission or the SEC, that lessens the need for a national type military response to the taking of a commercial asset in space. Hopefully, whoever would do that would be frozen out of reselling the services from that asset in the commodities exchange. They would be forbidden to participate further. So, having commercial mediation, if you will, in this forum for space might help. It couldn't hurt.
Do you envision this commodities future trading to be international, or is it a U.S. market only, and other countries would have to have their own commodities trading?
I would like to see, just as we have international commodities from a supply chain continuity point of view, traded on U.S. exchanges, but satellites of that exchange around the world. I would imagine that we would see that for space commodities. There are certain countries that should, given their leadership and their expressed aims, we would not allow those countries or their companies to trade, because we wouldn't be allowed to let them trade.
What is the timeline? Just before we went on break, you mentioned you hope to start forming the Board of Trade in the fall, but what is the timeline, and when do you envision this actually to be operating and functional?
So I'm pretty, for the reasons that we covered in the first segment, this is an open call for participation. The article we wrote is an open call. And so people will come together as trade when there's a critical mass to do so. I'm having ongoing conversations every week. Last week I was in D.C. For some of that. And the Board of Trade will be the driving force, not necessarily me or anyone else, to make a decision as to how soon the commodities exchange application would be submitted. From a from a scripting point of view, it takes about 120 to 180 days for the CFTC to process the application for an exchange to be permitted to operate, and they have a number of core principles for making sure the exchange is transparent and not manipulatable, et cetera, all of which are very standard from a financial level playing field point of view. So those are the kind of timelines that I'm looking at. Ideally, within 18 months, we would see the exchange operating, but that would require not only a board of trade, but we would have to raise the funding to stand behind the contracts that are traded on the exchange.
Any idea what kind of funding is needed for that?
No. One of the most fun parts of this, aside from working with Pittman there, is I actually had to start to put together an estimate of what five buckets of commodities would look like over the next 25 years. So raw materials, processed goods, services, derivatives, and indexes. How would those start to trade? And again, here's where the Board of Trade and the very particular knowledge about what element of metals or energy or whatever are needed to operate in space, but also once you're there, who else are you servicing and what's the timeline for those activities taking place. So there's a spreadsheet with a lot of dates and start dates for trading those commodities and growth rates for that I would take your listeners' input on which will trade first and as a result what next would trade in what quantity. That Excel spreadsheet, so to speak, for the space economy is an ongoing effort because that will tell us in part how much equity you have to raise to support an exchange for that level of volume of activity.
Is there a website where this information exists where people can go check it out?
They can email me if they'd like at bcahan@urbanlogic.org, my nonprofit.
At urbanlogic.
Dot org.
And what was the first part? B what?
My last name, bcahan.
Okay.
At urbanlogic.org.
Okay. Is there a separate kind of role or participation that organizations like NASA and maybe NOAA or maybe DOD focus on separate from the government at large, or is it all just listed under government?
They have their individual role as consumers and also as instigators of commodities. Clearly, you're right.
Uh-huh.
And getting their needs met through the exchange would be really vital.
So from that perspective, ESA might have a role as a consumer, and so might JAXA and other organizations, correct?
Absolutely.
And I guess
so I addressed JAXA a couple months ago. Yeah,
and I guess that could include Russia and China as well. I mean, it'd be hard to exclude them because they are consumers of space resources and products.
You know, let me get the U.S. side of this. Let's get the U.S. side of this figured out. Please don't give me government relations 101 on this call because I don't know how to deal with it, honestly, and I'm not going to step into that. There are countries who do respect the rule of law, and there are countries that don't. I'm not saying the countries that you mentioned do or don't, but that's implicit in being part of this exchange.
Okay, and we have another email question from Ben in Atlanta. And Ben said, people who are interested in this and space advocates, but not necessarily directly involved in any of the commercial space businesses, is there a feedback role or any kind of participatory role for those of us that would like to be involved in something like this, or do we actually have to be part of a commercial space company?
wrote the paper and put it out there as an open, you know, matter, sort of a crowdsource kind of a, what's the best ideas for doing this? What are the issues? So again, I would just urge the listeners to contact me or Bruce Pittman, and we can, you know, hear what ideas folks have and arguments. They, you know, we take FAQs seriously, frequently asked questions seriously, and try to address them. So I'm totally open to.
So David, I guess I would, you know, offer this up for, especially for the non-technical people out there. If you believe that there's a future economic, you know, renaissance potential in space, then I think this is one way that people that may have more of an economics or financial background rather than a technical or space background could actually participate in. And one is educate yourself on how these things work, because it is kind of fascinating and a little bit opaque about how these things actually came about and how they work. At least that's from my engineering point of view anyway. But again, this is one of those areas where, you know, what we're basically doing is suggesting that we follow the basically take the commodities exchange on Earth and move it out into space. There may be a hybrid approach here where we could take, you know, the elements of the terrestrial thing, but maybe some changes would be necessary or helpful to do that, to upgrade it for some of the opportunities and challenges inherent in space, in the space economy. So, again, if people wanted to help with this, so I think what we were trying to do with this paper was encourage, one, a discussion on this, and not like this was the end all and be all, the omega of evolution, but this is a starting point. This is our best idea at the time of what this might look like, and then encourage other people to participate in and kind of co-create this this new entity and have it be useful in helping us all co-create this future in space that we all hope will happen in the near future.
And David, let me jump in, because Bruce is right. I mean, okay. I teach at Stanford. I'm a lecturer in the School of Engineering. I teach finance courses to engineers. I teach ethical finance to engineers. And I had a couple of students from the Aero-Astro department take my courses, and they asked individually and collectively, what are you doing to help us finance our space activities? And I didn't know I was supposed to, so this is one of those responses to suggest that engineers are really brilliant at solving, you know, mission-focused problems. But in terms of building a space economy and the interdisciplinary skills that would be needed to make that actually a reality, engineers need to take a pause and learn some other stuff about why money does and doesn't show up to build what they want to build, or to build it at the robust level they want to build it. And this is an approach. And the other thing that motivated at least my wanting to work on this is I looked back at the 1980s roadmaps for human exploration of space and where we were supposed to be based on one of the roadmaps I saw was from Rockwell time, and I've seen the updated versions of it. And if we're going to do all those things as a species, we're going to need a lot of money to finance it. And we're going to need a really robust financial and risk transfer set of market mechanisms to do all of those things as quickly as engineering-wise we know we could build them if we had the funds. So this is an attempt to provide additional financing and this transfer / insurance services to an industry that you know really can grow very fast if it had those things.
When I would teach my graduate courses in business at the University of North Dakota Space Studies program, I would have a lot of people from SpaceX and other companies come and be guest speakers. And they were Gwen and others were consistently asked, are you hiring non-engineers like finance people, economists, and people like that? And the answer would always be, it's very limited. And what we have always found is it's easier to take an engineer and teach them some finance and economics than it is to take a social scientist or an economist or a financial person engineering. So they opt for the engineer and training them in finance and economics as needed per that particular job that that person is doing.
I mean, to that point, David, Stanford's Aero Astro Department is now adding, as a result of the paper, the two papers, an element of market formation to the curriculum to teach aero-astro engineers at Stanford and anyone else across campus what the role of market will be and needs to be for this to be a vibrant, segment.
And I always added that to my business, commercial space business classes, which was mostly attended by graduate students in engineering. It's interesting. You have another email for either one of you from Jerry in Dallas, Texas, and he said, are you getting industry feedback from specific companies or participants like Blue Origin, SpaceX, and others that are in the industry in various segments, including satellites, other launching companies, et cetera? Are you reaching out for that input yet, or have you received any of it?
I've received some from some of those that were just named or have been named on the call. And I've been mentored by a few of them. But I could always use more. I've reached out to the Lockheeds and the Boeings and the Northrops, and it would be great to have, Satellite and the other folks give their input and express their interest, including folks like Bigelow and the others.
Has there been any attempt to interest or talk about this to the National Space Council folks?
I don't know how to get to them. So there was an early call with right before the administration took office, there was an early call with one of the advisors, but I haven't seen that followed up.
Pittman, any on your part, any outreach toward the National Space Council?
No. But that's not a bad idea. But no, I haven't seen that they've done that, and we haven't initiated anything. But might be interesting to see if they would find this something that they would be interested in.
Well, I would think they would, but then you never know what may interest somebody. that's a hard one to predict. Where do you, if this were to happen, compared to where we are today with commercial space, where would we be in 20 or 25 years? Do you think we'd be classified as a truly spacefaring world with truly spacefaring economies? Would it make that much difference that we could cross over into that sort of ultimate goal of an arena for commercial space?
David, that doesn't come
on our second glass of Bruce's great red wine. We think so.
So I wanted to kind of pull on that thread because I think that's a really important thing. And actually, I'm in the process of writing another paper on this. And it goes, we spent the last 50 years exploring space. And I think we're right on the verge of starting to go to the next phase of it, which I think is the development and the utilization of space. And I think this is where this commodities future exchange could be. And so I wanted to just make an analogy, here to, again, going back to the aviation industry. The first commercial airplane flight in the United States was in 1914, and it was a 34-minute flight from St. Petersburg to Tampa. Airline only lasted for like 4 months, and they went bust. But, I mean, it was a start. And then 20-something years later, 22 years later in 1936, the DC-3 entered service, and that was right about the time. And 2 years later, 1938, was the first time over 1 million U.S. passengers flew by air. So you went from one person in 1914 to a million people in 1938. In 1957, the Boeing 707 entered the market, and the next year, 1958, was the first year that more people flew by air than took the train for long distance travel. And then today, we have 25,000 flights a day on 6,000 aircraft just in the United States, over 3 billion passengers a year worldwide. And this is something that even the Wright brothers would not have believed. 50 million tons of air cargo per year, valued at over $6.4 trillion. If you go to your grocery store today and look at the number of products in the produce section that are from, you know, South America or Chile or Africa, it's amazing that you can ship fruits, vegetables, and cut flowers between continents at reasonable prices and still make a profit. So the question here is that kind of commercial aviation industry that's grown up over the last 50 to 100 years, is the same kind of revolution possible into space? And I think the answer to that is yes, but I'm one of the world's great optimists. And I think that a commodities future exchange like we're talking about could be play a key role in that emergence.
What do you think the risks are for that might impede the commodities future exchange? What are you alert to make sure doesn't happen? What would be some of the adverse risks that could come up and throw you for a detour?
I mean, some of what I've seen so far are folks who hear this idea and then sort of get very excited about it and then try to go off and do it and kind of muck up the conversations with the regulatory and other communities. That doesn't help. This is an open, you know, call, and I think the more we come together as to the strategy for and the strategic need for and function for this commodities exchange, the more successful it will be seen by the licensing authorities as speaking with one voice on behalf of many participants in the industry. As Bruce says, you need volume of transaction to make a commodity available on a continuous basis. You need to show that there's an accelerating demand curve with the investment in the DC-3 or the Boeing 707 or whatever to justify the financing of those activities. So, you know, having critical mass, having people come together, trying to step out of some of their stovepipe franchises would be really, really helpful. This is not to say everyone may have a unique way to build a commodity or to provide a certain commodity service. That uniqueness will be preserved with this, but the definition of what a 120 electric plug is doesn't mean that there's only one kind of electric device that plugs into the wall. There's certain things that are basic infrastructure, and a commodities exchange is basic infrastructure for an economy. And that's what we're proposing. And I want to, you know, agree with Bruce, of course, that there may be a hybrid version of a commodities exchange that has grown up on Earth that would have to work in space. For example, we recently launched a journal for blockchain law and policy at Stanford in the law school that I'm part of. And it's conceivable and probably likely that as the outer, you know, reaches of the space economy go further and further from the Earth, you would want self-executing smart contracts to enforce or to provide the benefit of commodities that were traded for the exchange so that you don't have to rely solely on the terrestrial clearing mechanisms for those contracts. That's an example of something likely to be unique to the function of this exchange that would not be so for a terrestrial exchange.
Gentlemen, we're pretty close to the end of the program. How about each of you giving us some closing comments or pearls of wisdom or takeaways from today's show? And Pittman, let's start with you since Cahan started us off an hour and a half ago.
Okay, I think the point here was, again, to start a dialogue to get people, one, aware that such a thing is possible and to get a dialogue going here. So, again, as Bruce said, if anybody's interested in this, please reach out to us and you know, we'd be happy to share our ideas and thoughts with it. I guess the other part of this is not exactly clear what the timing of this should be, but I think that so we're not saying that we're ready to go start this tomorrow, but I think it is time to start having the dialogue about when is the right time now and to start preparing for this so that when it is the right time, you're not just starting from square one, with no forethought. Because one of the things you don't want to do is do this in a hurry and then mess it up, not do it correctly, not do it thoughtfully. So I think one of the things you want to make sure you put enough thought into this and that you get the right people inputting into this to make it successful. And then, you know, wait for the right time. And once you've got the critical mass, and then go execute it smartly.
Cahan, you have closing comments for us, pearls of wisdom?
I don't know if it's pearls of wisdom. I want to thank Bruce, you know, for his collaboration on this because he brings so much industry experience and history to the table. This activity needs to be part of research and development of aerospace. Thinking about space economics as part and parcel of how we want to grow the capacities in space is really key. And so I would put a plug in for the academic and the research and development on the economic and finance and insurance side at some relationship proportionally to the actual money invested in the physics of it. Secondly, this has all been an activity of my nonprofit Ethnologic, so I want to support a nonprofit pushing the envelope on behalf of everybody. That would be great. You can go to urbanlogic.org and see what we do. And then finally, as we've said all along, you may have great ideas for who we should talk to and why they would want to listen, whether that's in the space industry or, frankly, in terrestrial industries like mining and finance and insurance that would consider this certainly a new topic for business development and a new area to participate in growing the foundation for space economy. So, David, thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure. I want to thank you both for being with us, and I'm sure we'll talk about this some more down the road. So anytime you want to come on and update us and give us more information, please do so. And we thank both Bruces for being with us and for this very creative and important idea. As I said, I'm sure we'll hear more about it during future space show programs. Everybody, this is an important space day. It's actually an important day for everyone around the world, and you should make note of it and make sure your friends realize what took place quite a while ago now,
49 years ago today.
Yeah, and probably most of them won't have a clue as to what you're talking about, so use it as a teaching moment. And Rand Simberg and Bill Simon are back on Sunday with the 2018 version of their Evola Terra ceremony, so you don't want to miss that. That's always interesting and entertaining. Thanks to Bruce and Bruce for being with us today. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. And as always, keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.